to be American.
This is Democracy Optimist. Here's your host, Professor Joshua Douglas of the University of Kentucky Rosenberg College of Law.
Welcome to Democracy Optimist, where we discuss the current state of American democracy and even provide a dose of hope along the way. Many people just want to tune out all discussion of politics. Maybe that's because political rhetoric has become so jarring and so negative. It seems that we can't talk to each other anymore about divisive issues. We demean and belittle the other side instead of trying to find common ground. Our democratic norms suffer as a result. Why has misinformation and caustic political rhetoric defined our democracy? And what can we do about it? Here to discuss those issues is Jen Mercia. She is a historian of American political rhetoric and a professor in the Department of Communication and Journalism at Texas A&M University. She writes about political discourse, especially as it relates to citizenship, democracy, and the presidency, and has published three books, her most recent, Demagogue for President, The Rhetorical Genius of Donald Trump. Her work aims to make our communication with one another more democratic. Jen, welcome to Democracy Optimist.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start with some definitions. What exactly is rhetoric and how has it been used in our country's political history?
It might surprise you to know that rhetoric is a word that has a contentious definition. So people who study rhetoric don't even agree on the definition of the rhetoric of what rhetoric is. One way to think about it is the way that Aristotle describes it, which is the counterpart to dialectic. So if dialectic, the sort of questioning and answering procedure or method that Plato has Socrates use, leads to a certain kind of truth, a truth that pre-exists the conversation, right, that you uncover through the questioning and the answering. And the Greek word for that truth is sophia. Then rhetoric is another method that is of equivalent value and leads to a different kind of truth. And the Greek word for that is phronesis. So that's practical truth or practical wisdom. And the version of truth that comes from rhetoric is the product of the conversation or the debate or discussion. And so for philosophers, there is this eternal truth that preexists the conversation and the people who are deciding questions. And for rhetoricians, there maybe isn't eternal truth. And truth is, in fact, a product of the conversations and the debates that we have.
You know, that sounds very theoretical, right? Let's turn this into the more practical now. And thinking about today's politics, what sort of rhetorical devices can we recognize and sort of point to as, okay, this is something we want to at least analyze?
Oh, there are literally hundreds, maybe thousands of different rhetorical strategies that have been identified. So ever since ancient Greece, people have been cataloging and identifying these strategies. They sort of got expanded and rebranded in the Roman era and then again during the Enlightenment period. And so if you look up, you know, rhetorical strategies or rhetorical figures, you'll find, you know, devices that are about emphasis. So, you know, are we putting the emphasis in a certain word or a kind of repetition at the beginning of the sentence or an end of the sentence? Are we using strategies that are deceptive and fallacious? Those are the ones that I tend to focus on in my research. But there's lots of different strategies that people use to deceive others and manipulate them. So, you know, things like an ad hominem attack, for example, which is a redirection strategy. You're trying to shift the focus of the audience away from whatever is the central issue of the debate and to the person who has made the argument, and then have the audience focus on some quality about that person, usually in some way that denigrates them and denies them standing.
So, I mean, a lot of the things you described, I think you would probably agree, President Trump exhibits many of these. And, you know, you wrote a whole book Demagogue for President. And that book refers to Trump's rhetoric as, quote, genius. So tell us about that. Why is Donald Trump a genius, at least when it comes to the political rhetoric that he uses?
So a demagogue is an unaccountable leader. In ancient Athens, the demagogue would go into the assembly and they would urge for Athenians to adopt policies that they were then not responsible for the success or failure of those policies. Donald Trump has a particular genius at avoiding accountability. I think that that is quite clear and perhaps undebatable, really. He has developed over the course of his life these strategies, whether they're legal strategies, right? You know, so he's unrelenting in court, or whether they are rhetorical strategies. He is also unrelenting in the public sphere. He uses, you know, essentially what is and has always been thought of as war rhetoric when it's used by, you know, a president. But he uses it to attack the public sphere, to attack his opponents, to rally his supporters. And all of it is done with a aim of gaining power and also preventing himself from being held accountable. So, yeah, it is a certain kind of genius. I think it's a diabolical genius, but it's a genius nonetheless.
Well, so what lessons can we take from him, whether it's for future politicians or perhaps more poignantly in response to the rhetorical genius that is Trump?
Well, I think the most democratic response to anti-democratic strategy, which is what Trump uses, is to be able to show people how the strategy works, basically to pull back the curtain and say, you know, when he uses an ad hominem attack and he attacks the person instead of their argument, there's a reason why he does that. And this is how it works. And this is how it works for him. And so then people who are in the audience aren't fooled by it. Their attention isn't misdirected, right? And they're able to see with their own eyes what someone like me who's trained to see, you know, anti-democratic rhetorical strategy can see very easily. So, yeah, I mean, the best thing to do is to teach people how to see it so that they can decide for themselves.
So let's talk a little bit more about that with respect to different kinds of communication strategy, I guess. So many people have become used to labeling the other side's argument, their political opponent's argument, as propaganda. So what is propaganda and how does that differ from just regular political communication? Is that even term propaganda a worthwhile term to discuss?
I think that it is. And I actually teach a class on propaganda and I teach a class on political communication, and they're not the same class. Although they have taken on aspects, I think, of one another in the last 10 years. So a scholar like me who studies rhetoric and political communication would say that persuasion exists on a continuum. On one side, you have pure persuasion, and on the other side, you have pure propaganda. And the sort of middle between those two is a fuzzy line that makes it very difficult to say, you know, with any certainty that something is or is not propaganda. For me, a useful definition and one that I use with my students is that propaganda is persuasion without consent. And what I mean by that is that it is an attempt to change someone's mind or make them think or feel or understand history or forget history in a certain way that manipulates and coerces them and does not allow them to freely consent to what they are believing to be true. And there are, you know, sort of again, like the rhetorical figures, there are myriad strategies that you can use to deceive and manipulate people and deny them the free will and ability to consent to what they believe in. And what we've seen is that the more we learn about, you know, sort of brain science and cognitive processing and how emotions work, the more sophisticated algorithms get at, you know, sort of controlling what we see and how we see it, that propaganda is more and more ubiquitous. And in fact, that we've all learned to interact online as propagandists.
But the people who are engaging in the propaganda would say that they're telling people the truth, right? So, I mean, how do you effectively call it out?
Not necessarily.
I mean, so they would admit that they are. I mean, let's take the biggest lie in our democracy from the past 4 years, which is that, you know, Joe Biden didn't validly win the 2020 election. And, you know, a huge number of people still to this day think that the election was stolen from him. That's largely a product of propaganda, right?
Absolutely.
And yet the people who believe this will say, I've got the evidence, or, you know, the election was stolen.
Okay, so that's a great example. Let's sort of break that down a little bit. So Donald Trump, starting with the 2016 election, learned to say that Hillary Clinton was going to rig the election and steal it from him. He learned to say that from two conspiracy theorists, Roger Stone and Alex Jones on InfoWars. And both of them, without any evidence, started to talk about this on podcasts, on InfoWars. They're very dramatic about, you know, breaking news, this thing is going to happen. And they told Trump to start saying it. And almost as soon as Alex Jones and Roger Stone started to say it, Trump started to say it at his rallies and then on Fox News and other places. Roger Stone had already started a Stop the Steal website. He had done that during the primary process because he believed that Ted Cruz and others were going to try to steal the nomination from Trump. That didn't happen. And so they use that website to register supporters and to recruit poll watchers and things like that, which basically was just email harvesting because they didn't actually turn any of those people into poll watchers. So in the 2016 election, none of that mattered ultimately, right? Because Trump won the election. But he had been saying up until the point when he was announced as the winner, you know, why are we even having this election? Trump's going to win. And if Trump doesn't win, it's because she steals it, right? So all of that. So all of that is the same thing that he does in 2020, which is a poison the well strategy, right? So poisoning the well is when you prime people to believe that a certain thing is going to happen, so that if things, you know, turn out the way, in this case, Trump wouldn't want them to, he loses the election, there is already this doubt that's been cast onto it with no proof. So what that does is it alerts people and it creates a frame for understanding. So then people go out and try to find the proof, right, to support this narrative that they have been told is true. And so you have people in 2016, you have people in 2020. In both occasions, you have people who are like, wait, what was that? Oh, that looks shady. I saw a video. I read an article. I, you know, whatever, offering all of these things that are innocent or, you know, not at all what they think they are, offering them as proof that Donald Trump is right, right? Because he has poisoned the well. And so he creates this narrative that is based on conspiracy from literal conspiracy theorists mm-hmm. who know that it's not true, right? And he spreads it and creates a frame for understanding reality that predicts a certain thing will happen. Other people then try to make that thing happen, right? Naively, probably, right? They want to prevent Hillary Clinton or Joe Biden from stealing the election. And so they produce evidence. And then when you try to take that evidence to court, right, it doesn't stand up in court. And so, you know, the judges say 60 times, I think, or more, that this isn't true. That this isn't evidence of what you think it is. And in fact, Joe Biden did legitimately win the election. But at that point, people will not accept that, right? Because the frame is already there for them, the frame that makes them understand reality through this conspiracy lens. And conspiracy is a propaganda strategy that is so insidious because it is self-sealing. And what that means is that evidence is not allowed to contradict the narrative, right? And so if you say many, many judges, 60 plus judges, some of them appointed by Trump, all say, no, this didn't happen. They say they're in on the plot too, If you say, no, the evidence is not there, they say they hide that evidence. If you say, no, that evidence is not what you think it is, they say you're a liar, right? And so it's self-sealing in the way that the evidence is not allowed to puncture the narrative. The narrative is always stronger than any disconfirming evidence. And it's in fact the logic of conspiracy itself. And so Donald Trump deploys this conspiracy theory. He poisons the well. He frames reality. He gets people to buy into it. They believe themselves to be heroes, heroically defending, right, the election process and the integrity of the elections and the democratic process in the United States. And they refuse to believe because the conspiracy logic allows them to never have to believe.
So the old saying, the truth will set you free. But here the truth is not setting us free, right? So what do we do?
Conspiracy is tricky. there are always going to be people who believe that we didn't land on the moon. There will always be people who believe that the earth is not round. There will always be people who believe that Donald Trump legitimately won the election in 2020. That is the way conspiracy works. And all you can do, in my mind anyway, is to try to use Occam's razor, right? Which is to say that the simplest solution is usually the correct solution. And a conspiracy is, you know, a lot of moving parts, right? Like if you really are thinking that Joe Biden was able to control the outcome of the election, was able to rig the election, then that would mean he had operatives in counties and in, you know, election boards and in, right, all of these places all at the same time, that he had organized this massive, you know, sort of workforce to ensure that he won the election. And that he had the news media in on it, and he had the courts in on it, and he had, in fact, members of the Trump administration in on it, right? And if all of that is true, then we would definitely have that evidence, mm-hmm. right, at this point. You can't keep something like that a secret with that many people involved. And so Occam's razor would tell you that it's actually more likely that Donald Trump just lost. He lost the popular vote in 2016. He never had above, I think, 47% approval rating. He was the least popular person to ever run for president in the United States. He never had public approval. He was a calamitous failure of a president, right? And so I think you can use Occam's razor to say it probably makes more sense. The simpler solution is probably that Trump just lost.
So our conversation began with discussion of Plato and Socrates. And so I think this answers part of my question, which is that, you know, propaganda and caustic rhetoric is not a modern phenomenon. But in what ways does social media change the perception or the way it's spread or just our calculation about how we talk about rhetoric?
Yeah, there's a huge difference between communicating face-to-face and communicating via these mediated spaces, right? So we are much more agreeable in person than we are in a face-to-face interaction than we are online. Our online interactions are controlled by these algorithms that constantly feed us negative information and outrage. And that make it so that we want to express outrage and use very intense or emotive language ourselves. The act of scrolling changes the way we perceive reality because our brains aren't able to actually understand all of the information that we are taking in, right? And so it's very, very different from a kind of slow, deliberative conversation. Even the conversation that you and I are having is very different in terms of being slow and give and take and back and forth. You know, we're sort of adhering to certain norms of decorum and behavior that people just don't have to do online. And so this is what I mean when I say that social media has turned us all into propagandists. There's been lots of research that shows that people are more likely to post outrage online than they are to, you know, use outrageous language in real life. Outrage circulates faster around the internet than anything else. We learn to post outrage even if we are not outraged, because we want the dopamine hit that we get from the notifications and the retweets and recirculation of our content. Right. And so we've always known that you can use the media to scare people, right? Fear appeals work. If you are constantly showing crime on the network news or your local news, people are going to believe that the world is a scary place. Mean world syndrome is what it's called. So we've always known that the media can have this effect. Doesn't matter whether it's online or not. But the more we learn about how it works, the more sophisticated the engineers are on the other end of making these algorithms and these apps and these products that that keep us all engaged and enraged.
So what's the one thing that a listener can do, the tangible thing that a listener can do with this knowledge now of how propaganda and rhetoric work in today's world?
So one thing that I've done with my students that has been sort of experimental this year, but has turned out to be, I think, a good thing, is I've had them learn about doom scrolling and about, you know, the mean world syndrome that we get from constantly consuming negative content. And to actively seek out solutions journalism and news and information. And so there's a great newsletter called Fix the News, and it's written by a guy named Angus Harvey is his name. He has a couple of TED Talks about this, and he produces this newsletter. It's all already published content, but it's stuff that people don't necessarily pay attention to. We have this negative news bias that makes us attend to threats and scary things. And so instead, he publishes this newsletter that is all about problems being solved around the world, whether it's climate, whether it's diseases that are being eradicated, whether it is technological innovations, the world embracing solar and wind energy and moving away from fossil fuels. There are so many stories of success and innovation that are published every day that we don't pay attention to. And paying attention to those stories, consciously seeking them out. And then what I have my students do is, post the sort of weekly hope scroll instead of doom scroll. It actually helped them to see that they consume the internet through their phones without any direction. Right. So what my students tell me is that they'll stay up all night scrolling through their phones for no reason, and that content is more likely than not doom and scary, scary stuff. And so they're depressed and they can't go to sleep, but they feel like they can't turn it off because, you know, there's more scary stuff. And so by specifically and intentionally, and that's the key word, consuming positive news, at least, you know, for a few minutes a week, what they realized is how much they had actually been doom scrolling and how it affected their mood. And it seems to me, and maybe people of my generation, like an obvious thing, but for especially younger people, they don't know the difference. They don't have what scholars call uses and gratifications for the media, right? They don't pick up a newspaper to find out what the weather will be. They are just constantly online. They're always online and they don't really know why. And it's directionless. And if you probably know, if you're directionless online, the internet is going to suck you in a certain way and channel you into some outrageous content. And so one thing you can do is be very intentional about what you consume, because it absolutely affects your mood, your perception of reality. It infects your thoughts and feelings towards others, and makes us all less happy.
Yeah, I just pulled up that website on my computer, fixthenews.com, and it looks like there's tons of stories about the good news out there in the world. Jen Ruchia is a professor in the Department of Communication and Journalism at Texas A&M University and an expert on rhetoric. Jen, thanks for joining Democracy Optimist.
My pleasure.
Josh, you talked about rhetorical devices and how they're used today when we're kind of awash in rhetoric. Why is it important to us, to the general voting public, that we understand what this tool, political rhetoric, is and how it works?
Because I think we need to make sure we're not accepting at face value the things we're hearing from politicians or from those who have every incentive to tell us something because it helps them stay in power or their side stay in power. I think this all goes to media literacy, social media use, and social media literacy. As she said, propaganda is nothing new, but the ways that it's being deployed today, I think, offer a unique perspective about how the general public needs to be ever vigilant about what we're hearing from our leaders and really questioning things. I found it sort of frustrating to hear about how she said conspiracies are really hard to push against, right? And they'll endure. But the more knowledge we have about the tools that are being used, the better equipped we are to respond.
Jen Ruchia talked about propaganda and how it was created to make people believe that the 2020 election was stolen from Trump. Here we are, 5 years later, with two-thirds of Republicans saying that they do believe the election was stolen. It seems like a pretty clear statement about the power of propaganda in today's American society. Maybe more pervasive, maybe more powerful than many of us realize.
I think that's right. I mean, that's one reason I really wanted to have her on the show, because propaganda is such an important part of what's going on in democracy today. When, you know, up is down, when so many people still believe that the 2020 election was stolen, even though we have the evidence, we have the judges. And her point about how you'd see Donald Trump and his supporters say these things to the public, and then they would go to the courts, and the courts would say, you don't have the evidence. This is just speculation. And yet that message still can't get through to the public. I think on the one hand, it's really scary for what it tells us about how the general public can be basically manipulated. On the other hand, it gives us an opportunity. By understanding, we can think about ways to cut back against this.
Thanks for joining us for Democracy Optimist, a special Eastern Standard series produced by Dynamics Productions and WEKU. Joshua Douglas, writer and host. Mike Savage, executive producer. I'm the series producer, and Neil Kesterson is technical director and sound designer. Democracy Optimist's theme song, American, by Madeline Peru. Eli Raymond, research assistant. Caitlin Douglas, graphic designer. Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at democracyoptimist.com, and podcast versions are available on Apple, Spotify, and the NPR app. Want to get in touch? Our email is democracyoptimist@gmail.com. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Democracy Optimist from Eastern Standard and WEKU. Thank you.
the fight.